Welcome to the Heart of Our Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Heart of Our Messianic Ministries director, Pastor Bob Morris, will continue tracing important events in the history of the modern state of Israel. Pastor Bob will conclude his explanation of the 1973 Yom Kippur War and continue discussing significant events from 1973 until the year 2000. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Heart of Our Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now let's begin lesson number 15. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Let's begin lesson 15 of our current class, the First Regathering Modern Israel. As we left off at the end of lesson 14, we were at the end of the Yom Kippur War in 1973. The Yom Kippur War, if you'll remember, caught Israel by surprise. Israel was fighting on two fronts, the northern front against the Assyrians. The Syrians did a massive attack against the Israelis, but overextended themselves and were pushed back almost to the gates of Damascus. On the southern front, the Egyptians came across, but were decimated a few days later by Israeli artillery and Israeli armor. A seam opened up between the two Egyptian main armies, and Ariel Sharon brought a small force across. That small force allowed eventually major Israeli tanks to cross into Egypt, and the Egyptian supply lines were being chewed up by the Israeli armor. And now let's pick up October 22nd. So let's pick up lesson 15 now. October 22nd, 1973, the UN approved a Soviet and American appeal for the ceasefire to go into effect in 12 hours. Israel accepted the ceasefire the same day that Jordan and Egypt did. The ceasefire deadline found the 3rd Egyptian Army hopelessly trapped, with its supply lines cut and large numbers of troops fleeing in disorder. Under these circumstances, the Egyptians ignored the ceasefire and struck repeatedly at the Israelis in an effort to open up an exit corridor for the Egyptian 3rd Army. A new ceasefire was proposed for October 24th. It was accepted, and Israel fought up to the very last moment. When the fighting stopped, 3 divisions had penetrated 25 miles into Egypt, and they dominated the southern half of the West Bank of the Suez Canal. On the East Bank, Egyptian forces were deployed along the Bar Lev line to a depth of 3 to 5 miles. But in the last analysis, the Israeli armed force had won the most striking victory in their history. The combined Arab forces actually had launched their offensive with more troops and weapons than those available to NATO in Europe. And they lost this huge army against a small country with the population unready and the army unmobilized. Despite the fury of the war, despite a surprise attack on two fronts, despite the incomparable advantages of Arab manpower and military equipment, Israel had held out, and eventually its forces had penetrated well beyond the enemy's borders. This is again another look at the sovereignty of God as he has worked in the history of Israel, preserving the nation, keeping her alive in spite of the forces of her enemies. It was in 1973 that David Ben-Gurion also died. Eventually, both sides in the conflict withdrew to approximately the same lines that existed before the war. And so the 1973 Yom Kippur War was essentially a stalemate. In 1975, an important resolution was passed in the UN, Resolution 3379, proclaiming that Zionism is racism. In 1977, the Likud comes to power. The 1977 electoral campaign in Israel gave every appearance of following earlier campaigns and turning into a contest between 3 major blocks. The largest block was the labor-dominated alignment. The other end of the political spectrum was the conservative Likud Party under the leadership of Menachem Begin. And then the third major block were the religious parties. Now, Labor members such as Yigal Alon and Abba Eben favored a substantial Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. Begin, on the other hand, perceived of an undivided land of Israel. And when the votes were counted, it was Likud. Likud was found to have increased its Knesset representation from 39 to 43 seats. The National Religious Party had enlarged its delegation from 10 to 12 seats, and the Labor Party had lost 33% of its strength, one-third of its strength. And never before in Israel's history had there been such a shift away from the Labor Party. The shift in Israel's political and economic course in 1977 was prefigured by a striking and no means dissimilar reorientation in Egypt. Anwar al-Sadat orchestrated the change personally. His reputation was at new heights following the Yom Kippur War of October 73, and the Egyptian president felt secure enough to embark on a far-reaching overhaul of Egyptian society, a, quote, liberalization in all fields. The new liberalization, of course, affected the economic field. Sadat wanted to introduce Western-style capitalism into Egypt, and he knew that this could only be established through peace. And the successful military crossing of the canal in 73 fortified the nation's desire for peace. The Egyptians felt that their honor had been restored. And so the Egyptian people found less humiliation in contemplating a new relationship with the enemy. Sadat explained his approach succinctly in his autobiographical work, quote, In Search of Identity. And let me quote from his work. We have recovered our pride and self-confidence after the October 1973 battle, just as our armed forces did. We are no longer motivated by complexes, whether defeatist inferiority ones or those born out of suspicion and hate. And this is why the opposing sides met soon after the battle dust had settled to talk matters over. With the fighting over, we harbored nothing but respect for one another. End quote. Now, the inauguration of a new administration in Washington in the United States added a unique momentum to the search for Middle Eastern peace. Jimmy Carter entered the White House in January of 1977. As he evaluated his future course, Sadat was presented with an unexpected opening by the Israelis. It happened that, upon forming his cabinet, Menachem Begin had astonished his colleagues and the nation at large by his choice of foreign minister. The choice was Moshe Dayan. Upon assuming office, Begin shared an interest in a trade-off. What he had in mind was an Israeli free hand in Judea and Samaria with a state of non-belligerency with Egypt. He wanted to trade that off. Give me a free hand in Judea and Samaria, and we won't be at each other's throats, was what he said to Egypt. Dayan, with his record as a dove in Sinai and a hawk on the West Bank, would be indispensable to Begin in selling the idea of such a trade-off, first to Egypt and then to Israel. Begin set about dispatching signals to Cairo of his willingness to strike a deal. Dayan ordered the draft of a possible Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty drawn up, and the paper was sent off to Washington for examination. U.S. endorsement was regarded as indispensable for leverage with the Arab enemy. As Dayan hoped, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and his advisors were impressed enough to request the president's personal intervention with the Egyptians, and Carter agreed. On September 10, 1977, the document was sent to Cairo, followed by a private letter from Carter to Sadat. The president asked Sadat to test Begin's sincerity. At that point, in May of 1977, General Yitzhak Hofi, director of the Mossad, which is the equivalent to the CIA, Israel's CIA, General Yitzhak Hofi uncovered information of a Libyan assassination plot against Sadat, and Begin decided to convey the information to the Egyptians. Morocco's King Hassan was regarded as a valuable conduit for such information, and he proved to be an effective one. Acting on the information, the Egyptian secret police seized the conspirators with extensive incriminating documents and weapons. Sadat was genuinely grateful. The Egyptian president accordingly sent word through Morocco that he was prepared to listen to serious Israeli proposals. On September 9, 1977, Sadat announced that he was willing to go to the Israeli parliament and discuss Israeli withdrawal from Sinai. In Israel, Begin was astounded. The prime minister was on the state radio the next day, issuing an open invitation to Sadat to come to Israel. 5 days later, in a note communicated through the U.S. embassies in Tel Aviv and Cairo, Begin formally and officially invited the Egyptian leader to address the Knesset on November 20th. Sadat accepted on the spot. On November 20th, 1977, Sadat faced the Knesset with a 40-minute address. In his speech, Sadat offered Israel the inducement his people had waited 30 years to hear. And I quote, this is President Sadat, "In all sincerity, I tell you that we welcome you among us with full security and safety. We used to reject you. We had our reasons and our fears. Yes. But I declare to the whole world that we accept living with you in permanent peace based on justice. Today, though through my visit to you, I ask you, why do we not stretch out our hands with faith and sincerity, so that together we might remove all suspicion of fear, betrayal, and bad intentions?" End quote. Upon his return, Sadat's reception in Cairo was tumultuous. Nearly a million people cheered him in his open car journey from the airport. However, initial discussions were agonizing for both sides, and soon Egypt and Israel were at an impasse. This brings us to 1978 and the Camp David Accords. It was the very lack of success that brought into play a critical procedural agreement between the Israelis and the Egyptians. Sadat and Begin consented to discuss their outstanding differences jointly with President Jimmy Carter at the presidential retreat at Camp David. It would take place at the urgent request of Jimmy Carter himself. Aware that the two Middle Eastern governments were reaching an irreconcilable standoff, the American president was determined that the momentum for peace between them would now have to be restored. It would be restored, if necessary, by exercising the full political influence of the most powerful country in the world. On September 5, 1978, Sadat and Begin arrived at Camp David. Eventually, after hard and emotional negotiations, two agreements were hammered out. One was entitled "A Framework for Peace in the Middle East," and the other, "A Framework for the Conclusion of a Peace Treaty Between Egypt and Israel." The arrangements were good for both sides. The Israelis would gradually return all the Sinai to Egypt, and normalized relations between the two countries would gradually phase in as well. A three-stage negotiation framework for the Palestinian problem in all its aspects was outlined as well. On September 17, 1978, a televised ceremony of signing took place at the White House. President Carter himself observed that a formal peace treaty between Egypt and Israel was to be negotiated and completed within the next 3 months. In November, late November 1978, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded jointly to Sadat and Begin. Well, the initial euphoria died away in Egypt, and serious opposition surfaced regarding the Camp David Accords. Bowing to the pressure, Sadat altered his understanding of the agreement. And by December, when the peace treaty was originally scheduled to be signed, the likelihood of peace appeared very dim. 1979. The Israel-Egypt peace treaty is signed. In March of 1979, President Carter, in an act of desperation, decided to travel personally to Egypt and personally to Israel in an effort to achieve a final breakthrough. A hectic 5 days of negotiations in Cairo and Jerusalem concluded with a peace treaty. 4 days later, on March 26, 1979, in a White House ceremony, Sadat and Begin placed their signatures on a formal treaty of peace between the two nations. The document terminated the state of war between Egypt and Israel, and Israel undertook to withdraw its armed forces, all of its armed forces, from the Sinai. Each party agreed to respect each other's sovereignty, to respect each other's territorial integrity, political independence, and the right to live within secure and recognized boundaries. Each undertook to conduct normal diplomatic, economic, and cultural relations with both countries, and to remove all discriminatory barriers to the free movement of people and goods. We move on to 1981. The key event in 1981 was Iraq's nuclear reactor destroyed by the Israeli Air Force, putting a stop to any movement by Iraq to create nuclear weapons. 1982, Israel completed their withdrawal from the Sinai. But in the same time, Operation Peace for Galilee was instituted. There was an attempted assassination of the Israeli ambassador to London, Shlomo Argov, on June 3, 1982. There was also renewed PLO shelling of northern Israel. And in response, Israeli forces launched Operation Peace for Galilee on June 6, 1982. Fighting continued until the 21st of August, 1982. In December, there was a start of direct Lebanese-Israeli talks, and an agreement was signed on the 17th of May, 1983 to withdraw all foreign forces from Lebanon. The Syrian government, however, rejected the call for the withdrawal of Syrian troops. Operation Peace for Galilee moved against the PLO stronghold in Lebanon. Now, Operation Peace for Galilee left Israel's army in ineffective occupation of southern Lebanon. Its tanks and self-propelled guns surrounded Beirut, trapping some 15,000 Palestinian guerrillas intermingled in the western part of the city, along with half a million local Muslims. Now it was time for Ariel Sharon to set in motion Operation Big Pines. Operation Big Pines was his carefully guarded master plan for smashing the PLO infrastructure in Beirut. In Sharon's scenario, the destruction of the PLO quasi-government in Lebanon would shatter Yasser Arafat's influence among the inhabitants of the West Bank. It was an audacious scheme, one that far transcended the officially proclaimed goal of Operation Peace for Galilee. Now is the moment, too, under the protection of Israeli air and artillery power, for the Falangist forces to set their military or their militias directly into West Beirut and complete the rout of the PLO. But here the arrangements hung fire. Despite heavy pressure from Sharon, the Falangist leadership refrained from military action. The Israeli command soon faced a painful decision. Their troops had pushed too far to leave the PLO enclave intact in Beirut. Yet the notion of moving directly into the city and using troops in bitter street-to-street fighting was unacceptable. Accordingly, after a few days of hesitation, General Eitan and his staff came up with an alternative, one that gained cabinet approval. The alternative was to uproot the PLO guerrillas by siege, by heavy aerial and artillery bombardment, and by halting munitions and food supplies. And during the next 2 months, some 400 Israeli tanks and 1,000 guns poured salvo after salvo into West Beirut. As Sharon had hoped, the pulverizing siege rapidly became unendurable for the Palestinian guerrillas. In late June, Arafat let it be known that he was prepared to withdraw his men from the city if appropriate terms and guarantees could be worked out. The Israelis rejected all qualifications. To intensify the pressure, Israeli troops on August 4, 1982, took over Beirut's international airport and began inching forward selectively into the western part of the city. The Air Force, meanwhile, carried out its single heaviest bombing of the war, 127 sorties in 10 hours. Simultaneously, naval vessels offshore joined in the bombardment, launching Gabriel missiles into West Beirut. Arafat was completely unnerved by then. And it wasn't Israel's hard stance alone that eroded its confidence. Where would his troops go? Not a single Arab country was willing at first to offer the Palestinians sanctuary. On August 12, Sharon ordered